Chapter 10. Knowing, not grieving, remembers a thousand savage and lonely streets. They run from that night when he lay and heard the final footfall, and then the final door. They didn't even turn the lights out. And then lay quietly on his back, with open eyes, while above the suspended globe burned with aching and unwavering glare, as though in the house where all the people had died. He didn't know how long he lay there. He wasn't thinking at all, not suffering. Perhaps he was conscious of somewhere within him the two severed wire ends of volition and sentience, lying, not touching now, waiting to touch, to knit anew so that he could move. While they finished their preparations to depart, they stepped now and then across him, like people about to vacate a house forever will across some object which they intend to leave. "Here, Bobby. Here, kitten, here's your comb. You forgot it. Here's Romeo's chicken feed, too. Jesus, he must have tapped the Sunday school till on the way out. It's Bobby's now. Didn't you see him give it to her? Didn't you see old big-hearted? That's right. Pick it up, kid. You can keep it as an installment or a souvenir or something. What? Don't she want it? Well, say, that's too bad now. That's tough, but we can't leave it lay here on the floor. It'll rot a hole in the floor. It's already helped to rot one hole pretty big for its size, pretty big for any size. Hey, Bobby. Hey, kid. Sure, I'll just keep it for Bobby. Like hell you will. Well, I mean, I'll keep half of it for Bobby. Leave it there, you bastards. What do you want with it? Belongs to him. Well, for sweet Jesus, what does he want with it? He doesn't use money. He doesn't need it. Ask Bobby if he needs money. They give it to him that the rest of us have to pay for it. Leave it there, I said. Like hell, this ain't mine to leave. It's Bobby's. Ain't yours neither, unless, sweet Jesus, you're going to tell me that he owes you, Jack, too. That he's been fucking you, too, behind my back on credit. I said leave it. Go chase yourself. It ain't but 5 or 6 bucks apiece. Then the blonde woman stood above him, and stooping, he watching quietly, she lifted her skirt and took from the top of her stocking a flat folded sheaf of banknotes and removed one and stopped and thrust it into the fob pocket of his trousers. Then she was gone. Get on. Get out of here. You ain't ready yet yourself. You got to put that kimono in, close your bag and powder your face again. Bring my bag and hat in here. Go on now. And you take Bobby and them other bags and get in the car and wait for me and Max. You think I'm going to leave either one of you here alone to steal that one off of them, too? Go on now. Get out of here. Then they were gone. The final feet, the final door. Then he heard the car drown the noise of the insects, riding above, sinking to the level, sinking below the level, so that he heard only the insects. He lay there beneath the light. He couldn't move yet. As he could look without actually seeing, hear without actually knowing, the two wire ends not yet knit as he lay peacefully, licking his lips now and then as a child does. Then, the wire ends knit and made connection. He didn't know the exact instant, save that suddenly he was aware of his ringing head, and he sat up slowly, discovering himself again, getting to his feet. He was dizzy. The room went round him slowly and smoothly as thinking, so that thinking said, "Not yet." But he still felt no pain, not even when propped before the bureau he examined in the glass his swollen and bloody face and touched his face. "Sweet Jesus," he said, "they sure beat me up." He wasn't thinking yet. It hadn't yet risen that far. "I reckon I better get out of here. I reckon I better get out of here. He went toward the door, his hands out before him like a blind man or a sleepwalker. He was in the hall without having remembered passing through the door, and he found himself in another bedroom while he still hoped, perhaps not believed, that he was moving toward the front door. It was small, too. Yet it still seemed to be filled with the presence of the blonde woman. Its very cramped, harsh walls bulged outward with that militant and diamond-surfaced respectability. On the bare bureau sat a pint bottle almost full of whiskey. He drank it, slowly, not feeling the fire at all, holding himself upright by holding to the bureau. The whiskey went down his throat, cold as molasses, without taste. He set the empty bottle down and leaned on the bureau, his head lowered, not thinking, waiting, perhaps without knowing it, perhaps not even waiting. Then the whiskey began to burn in him, and he began to shake his head slowly from side to side, while thinking became one with the slow, hot coiling and recoiling of his entrails. I gotta get out of here. He re-entered the hall. Now it was his head that was clear and his body that wouldn't behave. He had to coax it along the hall, sliding it along one wall toward the front, thinking, come on now, pull yourself together. I gotta get out. Thinking, if I can just get it outside, into the air, the cool air, the cool dark. He watched his hands fumbling at the door, trying to help them, to coax and control them. Anyway, they didn't lock it on me, he thought. Sweet Jesus, I couldn't have got out till morning then. It never would have opened a window and climbed through it. He opened the door at last and passed out and closed the door behind him, arguing again with his body, which didn't want to bother to close the door, having to be forced to close it upon the empty house where the two lights burned with their dead and unwavering glare. Not knowing that the house was empty and not caring any more for silence and desolation than they'd cared for the cheap and brutal nights of stale, oft-used glasses and stale, oft-used beds. His body was acquiescing better, becoming docile. He stepped from the dark porch into the moonlight, and with his bloody head and his empty stomach hot, savage, and courageous with whiskey, he entered the street, which was to run for 15 years.
This ends Disc 7.
The whiskey died away in time and was renewed and died again, but the street ran on. From that night, the 1,000 streets ran as one street, with imperceptible corners and changes of scene, broken by intervals of begged and stolen rides, on trains and trucks, and on country wagons, with he at 20 and 25 and 30, sitting on the seat with his still hard face and the clothes, even when soiled and worn, of a city man, and the driver of the wagon not knowing who or what the passenger was and not daring to ask. The street ran into Oklahoma and Missouri, and as far south as Mexico, and then back north to Chicago and Detroit, then back south again, and at last to Mississippi. It was 15 years long. It ran between the savage and spurious board fronts of oil towns where his inevitable serge clothing and light shoes, black with bottomless mud, he ate crude food from tin dishes that cost him $10 and $15 a meal, and paid for them with a roll of banknotes the size of a bullfrog, and stained, too, with the rich mud that seemed as bottomless as the gold which it excreted. It ran through yellow wheat fields, waving beneath the fierce yellow days of labor and hard sleep in haystacks, beneath the cold, mad moon of September and the brittle stars. He was in turn laborer, miner, prospector, gambling tout. He enlisted in the army, served 4 months and deserted and was never caught. And always, sooner or later, the street ran through cities, through an identical and well-nigh interchangeable section of cities without remembered names, where beneath the dark and equivocal and symbolical archways of midnight, he bedded with the women and paid them when he had the money, and when he didn't have it, he bedded anyway, and then told them that he was a Negro. For a while, it worked. That was while he was still in the South. It was quite simple, quite easy. Usually all he risked was a cursing from the woman and the matron of the house, though now and then he was beaten unconscious by other patrons to waken later in the street or in the jail. That was while he was still in the, comparatively speaking, South, because one night it didn't work. He rose from the bed and told the woman that he was a Negro. "You are?" she said. "I thought maybe you were just another wop or something." She looked at him without particular interest. Then she evidently saw something in his face and said, "What about it? You look all right. You ought to have seen the shine I turned out just before your turn came." She was looking at him. She was quite still now. "Say, what do you think this dump is, anyhow? The Ritz Hotel?" Then she quit talking. She was watching his face, and she began to move backward slowly before him, staring at him, her face draining, her mouth open to scream. Then she did scream. It took 2 policemen to subdue him. At first, they thought that the woman was dead. He was sick after that. He didn't know until then that there were white women who would take a man with a black skin. He stayed sick for 2 years. Sometimes he would remember how he'd once tricked or teased white men into calling him a Negro in order to fight them, to beat them or be beaten. Now he fought the Negro who called him white. He was in the North now, in Chicago and then Detroit. He lived with Negroes, shunning white people. He ate with them, slept with them, belligerent, unpredictable, uncommunicative. He now lived as man and wife with a woman who resembled an ebony carving. At night he would lie in bed beside her, sleepless, beginning to breathe deep and hard. He would do it deliberately, feeling, even watching, his white chest arch deeper and deeper within his ribcage, trying to breathe into himself the dark odor, the dark and inscrutable thinking and being of Negroes, with each suspiration trying to expel from himself the white blood and the white thinking and being. And all the while his nostrils at the odor which he was trying to make his own would whiten and tauten, his whole being writhe and strain with physical outrage and spiritual denial. He thought that it was loneliness which he was trying to escape, and not himself. But the street ran on, cat-like. One place was the same as another to him, but in none of them could he be quiet. But the street ran on in its moods and phases, always empty. He might have seen himself as in numberless avatars, in silence, doomed with motion, driven by the courage of flagged and spurred despair, by the despair of courage whose opportunities had to be flagged and spurred. He was 33 years old. One afternoon, the street had become a Mississippi country road. He'd been put off a southbound freight train near a small town. He didn't know the name of the town. He didn't care what word it used for name. He didn't even see it anyway. He skirted it, following the woods and came to the road and looked in both directions. It wasn't a graveled road, though it looked to be fairly well used. He saw several Negro cabins scattered here and there along it. Then he saw, about a half mile away, a larger house. It was a big house, set in a grove of trees, obviously a place of some pretensions at one time. But now the trees needed pruning, and the house hadn't been painted in years. But he could tell that it was inhabited, and he hadn't eaten in 24 hours. That one might do, he thought. But he didn't approach it at once, though the afternoon was drawing on. Instead, he turned his back upon it and went on in the other direction. In his soiled white shirt and worn serge trousers, and his cracked, dusty, town-shaped shoes, his cloth cap set at an arrogant angle above a 3 days stubble. Yet even then he didn't look like a tramp, at least apparently not to the Negro boy whom he met presently coming up the road and swinging a tin bucket. He stopped the boy. "Who lives in the big house back there?" he said.
"That where Miss Burden stay at."
"Mr. and Mrs. Burden?"
"No, sir. Ain't no Mr. Burden. Ain't nobody lived there but her."
"Oh, an old woman, I guess."
"No, sir. Miss Burden ain't old. Ain't young neither."
"And she lives there by herself? Don't she get scared?"
"Who gonna harm her right here in town? Colored folks around here looks after her."
"Colored folks look after her?"
At once, it was as if the boy had closed the door between himself and the man who questioned him.
"I reckon ain't nobody around here gonna do her no harm."
"She ain't harmed nobody."
"I guess not," Christmas said. "How far is it to the next town over this way?"
"About 30 miles, I see." "You ain't fixin' to walk it, is you?"
"No," Christmas said. He turned then, going on. The boy looked after him. Then he too turned, walking again, the tin bucket swinging against his faded flank. A few steps later, he looked back. The man who had questioned him was walking on, steadily, though not fast. The boy went on again, in his faded, patched, scant overalls. He was barefoot. Presently he began to shuffle, still moving forward, the red dust rising about his lean, chocolate-colored shanks and the frayed legs of the too short overalls. He began to chant, tuneless, rhythmic, musical, though on a single note.
"Say don't din, din don't who, won't dad yaller gals, puddin' don't had."
Lying in a tangle of shrubbery, 100 yards from the house, Christmas heard a far clock strike 9, and then 10. Before him the house bulked square and huge from its mass of trees. There was a light in one window upstairs. The shades weren't drawn, and he could see that the light was a kerosene lamp, and now and then he saw through the window the shadow of a moving person cross the further wall. But he never saw the person at all. After a while, the light went out. The house was now dark. He quit watching it then. He lay in the copse, on his belly on the dark earth. In the copse the darkness was impenetrable. Through his shirt and trousers it felt a little chill, close, faintly dank, as if the sun never reached the atmosphere which the copse held. He could feel the never-sunned earth strike slow and receptive against him through his clothes, groin, hip, belly, breast, forearms. His arms were crossed. His forehead rested upon them. In his nostrils the damp, rich odor of the dark and fecund earth. He didn't look once again toward the dark house.
He lay perfectly still in the copse for more than an hour before he rose up and emerged. He didn't creep. There was nothing skulking, nor even especially careful about his approach to the house. He simply went quietly, as if that were his natural manner of moving, and passed around the now dimensionless bulk of the house toward the rear, where the kitchen would be. He made no more noise than a cat as he paused and stood for a while beneath the window where the light had shone. In the grass about his feet, the crickets, which had ceased as he moved, keeping a little island of silence about him, like thin yellow shadow of their small voices, began again, ceasing again when he moved, with that tiny and alert suddenness. From the rear of the house, a single-story wing projected. "That'll be the kitchen," he thought. "Yes, that'll be it." He walked without sound, moving in his tiny island of abruptly ceased insects. He could discern a door in the kitchen wall. He would have found it unlocked if he'd tried it, but he didn't. He passed it and paused beneath the window. Before he tried it, he remembered that he'd seen no screen in the lighted window upstairs. The window was even open, propped open with a stick. "What do you think about that?" he thought. He stood beside the window, his hands on the sill, breathing quietly, not listening, not hurrying, as if there were no need for haste anywhere under the sun. "Well, well, well, what do you know about that? Well, well, well." Then he climbed into the window. He seemed to flow into the dark kitchen, a shadow returning without a sound and without locomotion to the all-mother of obscurity and darkness. Perhaps he thought of that other window, which he'd used to use, and of the rope upon which he'd had to rely. Perhaps not. Very likely not. No more than a cat would recall another window. Like the cat, he also seemed to see in the darkness as he moved, as unerringly toward the food which he wanted, as if he knew where it would be. That, or were being manipulated by an agent which did know. He ate something from an invisible dish with invisible fingers, invisible food. He didn't care what it would be. He didn't know that he'd even wondered or tasted until his jaw stopped suddenly in mid-chewing, and thinking fled for 25 years back down the street, past all the imperceptible corners of bitter defeats and more bitter victories, and 5 miles even beyond a corner where he used to wait in the terrible early time of love for someone whose name he had forgot. 5 miles even beyond that it went. "I'll know it in a minute. I've eaten it before somewhere. In a minute I will." Memory clicking, knowing. "I see. I see. I more than see, hear. I hear, I see my head bent. I hear the monotonous, dogmatic voice which I believe will never cease, going on and on forever. And peeping, I see the indomitable bullet head, the clean, blunt beard, they too bent, and I thinking, how can he be so not hungry, and I smelling my mouth and tongue weeping, the hot salt of waiting, my eyes tasting the hot steam from the dish. It's peas," he said aloud. "For sweet Jesus, field peas. Cooked with molasses." More of him than thinking may have been absent. He should have heard the sound before he did, since whoever was creating it was trying no more for silence and caution than he had. Perhaps he did hear it, but he didn't move at all as the soft sound of slippered feet approached the kitchen from the house side of it, and when he did at last turn suddenly, his eyes glowing suddenly, he saw already beneath the door which entered the house itself the faint approaching light. The open window was at his hand. He could have been through it in a single step almost, but he didn't move. He didn't even set down the dish. He didn't even cease to chew. Thus he was standing in the center of the room, holding the dish and chewing, when the door opened and the woman entered. She wore a faded dressing gown, and she carried a candle, holding it high so that its light fell upon her face, a face quiet, grave, utterly unalarmed. In the soft light of the candle she looked to be not much past 30. She stood in the door. They looked at one another for more than a minute, almost in the same attitude, he with the dish, she with the candle. He'd stopped chewing now.
"If it is just food you want, you will find that," she said, in a voice calm, a little deep, quite cold.